Morning.
Good morning.
Hi, everybody. I want to read you something this morning from Sounds of Valley Streams, Enlightenment in Dogen Zen. This is by Francis Cook, who's one of my favorite Buddhist writers. He wrote, he translated 9 essays from the Shobo Genzo, and he also wrote a wonderful commentary up front. And I want to read a little bit about what Cook says about what Dogen said about the enlightened life. He says, Dogen presents enlightenment as the way in which one encounters Dogen presents enlightenment as the way in which one encounters an event authentically by penetrating thoroughly to its true reality. Unenlightened people encounter events from the perspective of the little self that evaluates and categorizes all events in terms of personal meaning. Because of problems of limited perspective, an encounter can be authentic only when the limiting and distorting self has been forgotten or dropped off in the encounter. Dropped off is a phrase that Dogen uses a lot. This reality that he's talking about is that which we encounter in the absence of the craving, fear, sentimentality, prejudice, discrimination, and judgment that originate in the small self. So the mysterious reality or true nature that Dogen talks about is just some ordinary thing met selflessly in total openness to its being. Dogen says that to do this always, over and over, as we encounter each event, is to be continually re-enlightened. So meeting some ordinary thing in total openness is to be enlightened continually over and over in our lives. And I like that take a lot because it places enlightenment right in the middle of our lives, you know, not some ethereal thing out there somewhere that only very special beings can attain. It's right here. And Dogen says that over and over, it's his promise to us, I guess you'd say. Or maybe his invitation to us. Suzuki said this, Shunryu Suzuki said this in one of my favorite quotes by him. He said, Zen is making your best effort. How does this go? Zen is making your best effort in each moment forever. And I think that's kind of the same thing. Everybody likes it till you get to the forever part. Zen is making your best effort. So how do we do that? I mean, that question arises immediately, you know. How do you do that? Well, our number one practice for doing that, of course, is zazen, is seated meditation, which we do every day, every day, every day, forever, with frequent retreats, every so often, forever. But there are also a lot of other practices that we can do that will help us with this, that'll help us learn in this way. And I want to talk about one of those this morning that I've been studying for 10 years now, and that's the practice of formal traditional Zen sewing. We have here in town one of the most experienced and respected Zen sewing teachers in the country, maybe in the world. We're really lucky in that way. She's the widow of our founding teacher, Katagiri. Her name is Tomoe Katagiri, and she teaches the practice of Zen, of sewing Buddhist robes. And I sewed my first small robe, my first roksu, with her 10 years ago this summer. And since then, I've been what I call a sewing companion for 5 different groups of people who were sewing these small robes. And I tried to count last night. I think I've helped sew on about 15 large priest robes. And it's been quite a practice. And I've talked about the symbolism of these robes before, so I'm not going to talk about the symbolism or the history too much of it today. But I want to talk about sewing practice as an ordinary thing that we can meet selflessly in total openness. So sewing as an ordinary thing that we can open ourselves to and use as a vehicle to see if we can live our lives in an enlightened way or in an enlightening way. So I need to give a little bit of quick background first. For those of you who don't know what these are, this is called a raksu, and it's a small version of the big robe that you see Buddhist priests wearing. And we sew them. They were, until about the 1700s or 1800s, I think, these didn't exist, but they were invented in the 1700s or 1800s by Japanese monks as a very practical alternative to wearing their big robes when they were doing things like traveling or cleaning or cooking and things like that. So they came up with these that are in pretty much the same design as the big robes. And later, lay people started to wear them also. And now we have a tradition of lay people going through a process in which they affirm that they're going to live their lives according to the Buddha's way. And there's a ceremony where they declare that intention in front of other people. And as part of the preparation for that, one of the things that they do is sew one of these. You can look around the room and see a few of them here. So we sew them, and we sew them according to a prescribed method that goes back 2,500 years to the Buddha himself. And when we sew them in silence. We aren't talking, we aren't watching TV, we aren't listening to the radio, we aren't doing other things. And with every stitch that we sew on these things, we say to ourselves, I take refuge in Buddha. So, or in Japanese, it's Namo Kie Butsu. I like to say it in Japanese because that gets me away from too much thinking, you know. So if I say Namo Kie Butsu, it makes it easier for me to stay right there with the stitch. And that's a big part of the point of it, is to stay right there while you're making it. So that's what these things are, and that's what we're going to be talking about, is the sewing of these things this morning. But getting back to Cook for a minute, he talks about three aspects or three facets of enlightenment in Dogen's writing. And one of them is a liberating aspect of enlightenment. And then he also talks about a self-transformative aspect of enlightenment, and also enlightenment as the ability to see the sacred in everyday things. And so I want to talk about those three things in terms of sewing practice. So, liberating. Originally in Buddhism, liberating, when they talked about liberation, they talked about it as liberation from the endless wheel of rebirth into this samsaric world, this world of sorrows. But nowadays, what you will hear more in this country, in the West at least, is liberation from the three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance, or greed, anger, and delusion. We sometimes translate them. I think that in order to liberate yourself from the three poisons, you have to do three things. This is the first ever Buddhist list I've ever come up with. Buddhism is full of these lists. And I used to think, you know, they always tell you these lists are because Buddhism was originated in a pre-literate society and people needed to memorize things. But I decided this last week that the real reason was that it made it easier for people to teach, you know, to have lists, to be able to say it's these three things. So what were my three things anyway? The three ways, or the three steps to this liberation. I think the first thing you have to see, if you want, the first thing you have to do if you want to liberate yourself from the three poisons is you've got to be able to see them. You know, we go through our lives and we don't even see it when greed is coming up in us. We don't even see when we get angry. You know, maybe we don't even know that we're angry. We certainly don't know when we're deluded or ignorant, I don't think, usually. So we need to be able to see them as they arise in us. We need to be able to see that greed arising, that anger arising. And I think that's easier to do when you're doing a discrete task like sewing. You know, it's easier to see when you prick your finger and all of a sudden, whoa, I'm angry. How could I be such an, you know, You can see it rising in a discrete task like that. Easier, I think, than you can see it maybe in work situations or in your Thanksgiving meal with your family. You know, when you're dealing with money, things like that. We're too used to those. But if you put yourself in a situation where you're doing this one thing, it's easier to see those things as they rise up. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in a minute. So that's step one. It's seeing them when they arise. And then step two is when you see these things as they arise, naturally they loosen their grip. You know, their grip on you just loosens. You know, when you can see yourself, you know, going into greed over, for example, we've got a really good carton of ice cream in my freezer at home right now. And when I can see that rising, you know, I believe I'll have myself a bowl of that wonderful organic ice cream. And when I can see that, you know, that sort of desire for it arising, the grip that it has on me can kind of loosen a little bit. And I can sort of make fun of myself over how I go for that ice cream. And it's the same way with the greed that that comes up with this with this sewing, and then eventually, when you can start to see these things arising, and the grip of them loosens, eventually they just drop away. You can just let go of them. There it goes. So. With greed, and its twin, aversion, I see this all the time with sewing practice. You know, greed is when we're sort of leaning into something. I want it. And aversion is the same thing, except we're leaning away from that. I don't want it. And I see this coming up in sewing practice all the time, starting before anybody even sees their material, because the people who don't know how to sew, or think they don't like to sew, or don't know why they have to sew, or just have some, you know, their mother used to make them sew, you know, whatever it is, they go straight into aversion a lot of times. I don't want to do that. Or you'll also see people who really like to sew and people who believe that they're really good sewers or think they are or really enjoy it, you know. Oh boy, I can't wait to get to the sewing part. You know, you also get, I can't wait to meet Mrs. Katagiri. You know, people really lean into these things or lean away to them. And I don't blame them. You know, when I think about this and I think, what if the practice that we did before we went through Zen initiation was rope climbing, and we had to do that first. I would be in aversion so fast. I couldn't possibly do that. So I have a lot of sympathy for the people who say I couldn't possibly sew one of those, especially because people who have sewn them like to tell horror stories about sewing. Zen students are like that. We like to tell stories about how hard this was and how much work went into it. And we also, and it's the same way that we like to tell stories about about how our sessions, our retreats, start at 6 in the morning and go till 9 at night. And sometimes we do it for 7 days. Zen students are like that. We take a lot of pride in this somehow. It's one of the things we do. So the next thing that I see greed coming up in and aversion is the color. I remember the first time I sewed my first one, I had this idea that I was going to get to sew any color I wanted. It didn't occur to me that wouldn't be the case, and so I decided that I really wanted a purple one. And I got there the first night, and we were handed this black material with brown thread, and I thought that was just the ugliest thing I'd ever seen. I just could not believe we were going to have to sew with those colors. And we were. And now people, I think, are more aware, usually, that that's going to happen. But still, I hear people saying, couldn't we have a different color of thread? This one's a little dark, or I can't see it, or it doesn't quite match. Or we sew with another group, and they buy their own material and their own thread. And I'll see people kind of looking over to see what color they got. So, it's funny. It's one of those things that we do. The other thing is that we have a case or a holder that we put them in. And we used to make them out of a different kind of material. But, boy, that sent people straight into it. So now we just use the same material for the holder as we used for the rakusu, on the first rakusu that you make. So they look very plain on the outside. But on subsequent rakusus, you can choose your own. And I'm not going to tell you whose this is, but sometimes they can end up kind of fancy, and they'll also have sometimes really gorgeous embroidery or tapestry material. I don't suppose anybody has one along like that that they would like to share.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. See, they can also be really pretty, or they'll have all kinds of embroidery on them, all kinds of things going on. But that first one is just the same black or blue material. So I see aversion and greed coming up with these all the time. The biggest of the three poisons, I would say, the biggest thing I see coming up, though, is anger, and it shows up as frustration. I don't want to say anger, really, but real frustration when people are sewing these things. You know, you think ahead of time that you're going to be just, sewing Buddha's robe, but we have to do it according to a very particular pattern, and the stitches have to be a very particular way. And it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do if you've never sewn before, and I think in a really different way it's just as hard to do if you've sewn a lot before, because it's different than any other kind of sewing that you've done. And so people get really, really frustrated by it. For me it's hard because there's a lot of folding of the material in really mysterious kinds of ways. It's almost like origami. And if you're spatially challenged, that part of it is really hard. But the harder part is after you have it all neatly folded and pinned, and then you sew a row of stitches that takes you maybe 45 minutes or an hour, and you show it to the sewing teacher, and she says, "That's wrong, take it out." People get really frustrated. And it's really, it's really hard for us. But eventually, at some point, ideally, during the course of the summer, this takes a whole summer, this practice, people kind of learn how to just touch that frustration and let it go. And just touch it and let it go. Tim has talked about this recently here. Just touching it and letting it go. So after a while, you're able to get to a point where you've sewn it, or you've pinned it, or you've done whatever you have, and you've put an hour or two of work into it, and you're told, "No, that's wrong. And you can just sort of bypass that frustration and go right to the, well, I was in that moment of being really happy with it, and now I'm in this moment of I've got to take it out. And the anger is really just extra. The frustration is really just extra. So you can just be in that moment of, oh, now it has to come out. All right, it comes out. And you can really hit a point of being able to understand that you're just doing this in Buddha's time, and things went wrong, and now we're going to fix them. And that is one of, when people can hit that point with it, and some people hit it right away. I don't like those people very much. Because I'm still learning that one. But other people, you know, it takes them the whole time, or maybe like me, it takes them 3 or 4 times through sewing one to learn that. But the wonderful thing about that is that it's something that you can generalize to the whole rest of your life. Something goes wrong, and just skip that whole, I'm really angry about this, you know, thing that's gone wrong that I don't have any control over. And just go straight to the, what am I going to do to fix it? And you can really start to see how that anger part of it, A, isn't doing you any good, which we all knew anyway, but is really just something extra that we bring in that causes our own selves a lot of suffering. So for me personally, that's been one of the biggest lessons. So we're learning how to let go of greed and anger, and the third one is delusion or ignorance. And of course, the biggest delusion about sowing these things is that what we're doing is sowing this fabric all by ourselves, when in fact what we're doing is we're sowing Buddha's robe with all beings. And I'm trying to decide if I want to say that I mean that literally. I think I do mean that literally. Especially that we're sowing it with all beings, you know. Because this is it just amazes me. It's a 25-year-old tradition that they tell us, 2,500, did I say 25? The 2,500-year-old tradition that they tell us the robes even look the same. The big robes look the same as they did back then. And so we are really, when we're sowing this, if we're sowing it, you know, watching our thoughts as they arise, saying, I take refuge in Buddha, we truly are saying it with everyone who's ever sewn a robe. We're saying it with everybody who is sitting in a third world sewing factory somewhere, sewing the shirts that we wear, getting pennies per day. We're sewing with everybody else in the Sangha. We're sewing with, you know, everybody who's ever taken a seventh grade home ec class. You know, we really are sewing with everybody when we're doing it. And I think when you sink into what you're doing, you can really feel that. And I think I also literally mean that we are sewing Buddha's robe. Buddha wore a robe just like the big ones that the priests wear, the large size version of these. And when we are sewing these, we're sewing them with all beings, we're sewing them for all beings. And when we're doing the sewing and we are staying right with it, we understand that the activity that we are doing is Buddha's activity, that we're in an enlightened state, and that we are Buddha, and maybe the person that we're sewing this for, you know, if we're sewing it for somebody else, that person is Buddha. It's Buddha's activity, and it's Buddha's robe. So the main delusion is that we're just sitting here sewing. And when I'm in the sewing class and I see people starting to chat, I feel kind of sorry for them because they're missing out on that. They're missing that opportunity to see that while they're chatting. The other delusion that we have is that that accomplishing it is the important thing about sewing these. It's the getting it done. And I fall into this one really easily when we're about 2 weeks away from the ceremony and there's always one or two people who aren't done yet. And I go straight into got to get it done mode, you know, production mode. But the physical work of it isn't the most important thing. I mean, obviously. The middle portion of it, the inside portion of it, is the Japanese word for it is kagami, which means mirror. And so it's we like to say it's a mirror of our practice. But I think that sends us into thinking about how, oh, my stitches are so bad, my practice must be bad. But really it's a mirror of our lives. And most noticeably, it's a mirror of our mind stream as we're doing it. It's a mirror of our mind stream. You know, if we're sitting here and we're, it's just like in Zazen. If we're sitting here and we're thinking the whole time about, you know, what happened at work today or something, or how Buddhist I'm going to be when I have this done and I get to wear it in the Zendo or something, then the kagami actually becomes a mirror of that for us and we can see it. Look at where my mind is. Look at where my mind's going. And if we can bring ourselves back over and over again, then it will be mirroring that calmer, more thoughtful mind stream. So that's the liberating aspect of enlightenment that Cook talked about. The second aspect of enlightenment that he talked about from Dogen's writings was the self-transformation aspect. And by that he meant a radical internal change based on Zazen. A radical internal change based on Zazen. And of course, as I was just saying, sewing these things is Zazen. It's exactly Zazen. It's literally Zazen. It's the same activity as Zazen. Because with every stitch, we're saying, I take refuge in Buddha. And with probably every third stitch, our minds are wandering off somewhere. And sometimes they're gone for, you know, two stitches, and sometimes they're gone for the whole class period. But eventually we notice that our minds are off here somewhere, and we bring them back. And we bring them back, and we bring them back endlessly. We watch what's coming up in our mind, and we let it go. And we watch what's coming up in our mind, and we let it go. The other thing is that when we're tearing out the stitches, the important thing, you know, that when you're asked to tear out the stitches, actually there's a couple of different ways it'll happen. One is you could be doing something that's upside down or backwards or in some way really seriously not right, so that when your raksu is hits another point in the process, it's not going to fit together right. And that's when Tomoe will tell you you have to take the stitches out. There are other times when one of your lines is a little bit crooked or one of your pieces is a little bit too wide or not quite wide enough, and she'll notice it and she won't say, you have to take the stitches out, but she'll point out what's wrong with it. At which point the student usually, usually says, should I take the stitches out or not? And she will say something like, you have to decide, it's your raksu. And, you know, I kind of enjoy watching those kind of exchanges because you just see the person's thoughts going right across their face. You know, sometimes it'll be, Yeah, it's my Roxu, so I don't have to take them out. You know, and it's sometimes just tell me what to do. And other times there are people who have a real perfectionist kind of tendency, and they just want it to be absolutely perfect. I've also seen her tell people, don't tear those stitches out. You know, it really is fine. But when you're talking about whether to tear out the stitches, the most important thing isn't whether the stitches are off a little bit, or my idea of whether they're okay, or your idea of whether they're okay. The important thing is watching your mind stream and watching what comes up in your mind stream at that point, and just seeing it come up. And that's where I talked about before. This kind of activity is the kind of activity where if you're looking for it, you'll see it all coming right up. You'll see it all coming right up. And after you've done that with sewing, maybe you can learn how to see those things coming up when you're in other situations. You know, when you're at work, when you're talking to somebody else, when you're in your usual life, you can see that kind of thing coming up because you've had the practice with this. Self-transformation. The other thing is that every time I've been in one of these classes, all six times now that I've helped with these Roxu sewing classes, I've learned something new. And I've also, in every single one, I've had to unlearn something that I was really sure of. Sometimes in one class, Tomoy will give us one instruction, and she'll tell us something pretty definitively, and this is why we do it. And then one or two classes later, she will give a totally contradictory instruction. And that used to drive me absolutely crazy, because I wanted, you know, I mean, I'm trying to learn how to do this. I want to know. And when I know it, I want it to stay known. But actually, it is such a better thing for me to not know, and to have things change, and to have to sort of deal with the fact that they're going to change. And I will go to Tomoy, and I've learned, I don't ask her, well, before you said this, and now you say that. You know, what happened? But if there is something that's confusing that I had pretty firmly, we do it this way because, and I don't understand the other way, I will ask her that. But I've learned to get away from the why. You know, why is this different? Why do we do it this way? You know, it doesn't matter. Just let it go. Just let it go. It's another opportunity to watch the mind stream. So that's a self-transformative aspect of it. And then Cook's third aspect of enlightenment from Dogen is the ability to see the sacredness of all things. And by that he says that Dogen means that all things have intrinsic value, perfection, and beauty. All things without exception, Dogen says, have Buddha nature. And by that he means all things, not just sentient beings, but all things. And sewing the Roxu is a very good way to start to see this, because we learn how to take care of them, and how to fold them, and how to treat them with some reverence and respect, remembering the entire time that it's both Buddha's very robe, and it's just some piece of material, you know, that it isn't some sacred cow that we put up on the altar and bow to, but it is a reflection of this vow that we've taken. And it has some sacred meaning because of that. And it has its own value and perfection, no matter what it looks like and no matter how many of the stitches you can take and look at and decide that one's a little off kilter. So it's both, and you can see them both in there. The first time that I ever saw this wasn't actually with Roxu's. It was with Joan Snyder O'Neill, who people were picking up, were putting away the Zafus and Zabutons one time, and she just said, you know, I just hate it when I see somebody throw a Zafu. She said, it makes me hurt. And it really made me stop and think, you know, these things, they have their own sacredness. There's something that, you know, that we use for this practice, and we ought to be treating them with some level of care and respect. And yet, you know, all they are, this is Zafu, and we can plump them up and, you know, turn them any which way, and we use them. They aren't something that we have to sort of carry around going, this is my sacred Zafu. So it's both at the same time. And when we can start to see that with our Roxus and with our Zafus and with our teacups, then maybe we can start to see it with everything, you know, with our rakes and with our, you know, kitchen utensils and things. On Wednesday mornings, I go over to Tamoy's. There's a sewing group that meets, and there's a guy there who's, I think he's a potter, and he spends a lot of time in Japan. And he was telling me, we had some pins that we were taking out, and they were kind of rusted, and so we were putting them aside so that we didn't accidentally use them again. And he told me that in Japan, in the temples, when they have a needle that's old that they aren't going to be using anymore, something's wrong with it, it's rusty or something, he said they put it in, they stick it into a piece of tofu, and then they put it on the altar in the temple, and they have a little ritual around it. And I was fascinated by that. And I said, well, and then what happens to it? And he said, I don't know. He said, maybe they smelt it down or something. I don't know. I have other cynical thoughts about what they might do with it, but I can just see somebody is saying, okay, we've done our ritual, now out it goes. But he also told me that when he's doing his pottery there, that when they wear out a pair of gloves, they don't just throw them away, that they have a little ritual and they burn them. And I thought, well, that's really wonderful. You know, I've been using these gloves to make this beautiful pottery. These gloves have been my tools, and I should treat them that way. You know, there's a sacredness in everything. So that was one of the most recent best things I learned from sewing. So anyway. So that's I guess what I wanted to say about this very formal, very traditional 25-year-old, 2,500-year-old enlightening activity. You know, that it can be enlightenment itself, that activity. It can be an enlightening activity. And it can bring enlightenment right here, in the middle of this, you know, very simple activity, and in the middle of any other activity, you know, just as easily we could have been talking about bowing practice, or eating with Oriyoki bowls, or working, or some Buddhist practice like Tonglen, or driving in traffic. You know, it's all enlightening activity, and that is, I think, the heart of Dogen's teaching and the heart of what his promise to us is. So that's what I wanted to say about sewing. Does anybody else have any sewing stories, what you learned in sewing or what you wish you had learned in sewing or in driving in traffic? Or
well, I was sewing my own case then. Ended up, the measurements were wrong, that Rosemary came on board a little bit later, and her Okesa measurements were smaller than mine, and we knew that there was something wrong. Her arms were bigger than mine.
Longer.
So we had to rip out a third of the Okesa. And I actually, in some way, found it helpful as much as taking a stitch and giving refuge to the Buddha, taking refuge in the Buddha, is when I'm ripping out the stitches, taking refuge in the Buddha, ripping out.
Oh, what a good idea. I remember that day. Were you there that day, Susan? I remember that day well. Because ripping out a third of the Okesa takes about 6 months to do. So ripping out a third of the Okesa, all of us who were there that morning were just bug-eyed. And I remember being just amazed at the apparent equanimity that you displayed. Because I would have had to leave the room for a little while.
I just decided there were a lot more difficult things in my life than ripping out a third of the Okesa. So I kind of put it in.
Yeah, and it got done. And it got done.
She helped get a lot of it.
She did.
You know, when you have to take things apart, just as much.
Yeah. I just about a week ago, was working on somebody else's Okesa, the big robe, and I had spent about 2 hours pinning and sewing this one long end on. And I had done it pretty carefully because I know that this is one place where I'm apt to make a particular mistake. And so I was very careful. And when I got done, I started to turn it and Tomoy looked over and said, "That's wrong." And I had very carefully, looking the whole time, made the same mistake that I always make. And it meant taking out 2 hours worth of work on somebody else's Okesa. But that was one where I could really just say, "Look at that! Let's take them out. Let's go." So it's something I couldn't have done 10 years ago. So, yeah.
One of the things that I really appreciated about sewing a rakusu is that in the person that I worked with encouraged people to have other people sew and to sort of pass that around, not just within the Zen community, but in your life, mm-hmm. people add stitches to it. And it's something that I'm really appreciative of because talking about a lot of what you talked about this morning, that means that, you know, that my rakusu has not only my own struggle of perfection and imperfection, but many people who I care deeply about has their struggle with perfection and imperfection in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nice to think of that every time that I put it on, that I bring pieces of my saga, you know, with me wherever I go with that.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful symbol of that. Yeah. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. That's part of it, is that you ask other people to put stitches in it. And my first teacher could actually look at his robe, and he would say sometimes, "Oh, that's the," you know, he would just pick up and, "Oh, that, well, there's so and so did that little section," and he could tell, or at least he said he could. And I thought it was lovely. I can't tell. I just remember that a lot of people worked on it. It was nice. It was nice.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And then never say to anybody, "Somebody else did these stitches."
Yeah.
Or tell them, "Here, you can sew this part," knowing it's going to get covered up later on. When Joan Snyder O'Neill turned 60, her Sangha made a new raksu for her. and they had a sort of a sewing party at one point, and so all the stitches along one side had been done at that gathering, and it was a lot of people who hadn't done it before and didn't really know. And so all the stitches on that side were just, you know, they were kind of these crazy kittywampa stitches. And she told me a couple of weeks after she got it that was her favorite part. She loved that part because she could see all of her Sangha members right there with her every time. So I thought it was a really good attitude.
Story I have to mention about my original. Okay, so as a student at Canterbury, I remember to my son, we'd go around and look at people's stitches, and she would do what one of my older sisters was a professional seamstress. She never looked at the outside. She would go right to the seams, and so my son came up and flipped this over and said, and said, you very good. And I was like a little chagrined, because when I started sewing this, I was in the classes you're talking about, and then I had a pretty serious accident. I used to drive city bus, and I was hit by another bus while driving. So I was in this neck brace and a brace holding my wrists together, and there's no way I could bend or do any of this. And almost completely unknown to me, Tejo would come over and stitch on my moxie every week. Mm-hmm. At the time that the class was happening, but I couldn't go. And then miraculously, when it came time for ordination, my moxie, I was just sitting there. And so for ordination, I took off my brace and I, you know, stood through the whole thing and got this beautiful, put it on, and then kind of forgot that I didn't do it. So I don't think I've told my son that. Beautiful stitches, she thinks I do. Tejo was just miraculous. Probably a treasure.
Yeah, Scott.
Maybe this is as a counterpoint to some of the other Roxy stories, but mm-hmm. I was in Rosemary's class and we saw our Roxy together. And overall, I found it to be difficult and completely unenlightening, and that I was frustrated the whole time throughout and just struggled with the whole thing. At one point, someone like was like this tall and elderly was looking over my shoulder and saying, is that the way you'd like it to be? you know, near weeping, my ego was crushed. It was just, you know, ground me down even further. So much more that I like, but it was sometime later, as in years, and it wasn't about sewing, but that aspect that you're talking about this morning. Of you know, the smallest of everyday acts being the place, if you will, where the fulcrum of where, I don't know if he's so brave as to say enlightenment like Dogen does, but where there is some kind of great value that resonates for me. And then when I sort of got a much better glimmer of the then the challenge, shall we say, my sewing blockers, it sort of made a lot more sense to me. The why of that and where I was at the time. So there's no enlightenment in the opposite.
Yeah.
I love the other aspect of the whole thing. And actually about that on reflection.
Yeah, it took me a long time after that first one. I think getting to be with these classes every couple of years has really given me a perspective on it. When we sew, the thing that you do after you sew it is you give it to your teacher, and they write on the back of it. And we had, I don't know, a dozen people in our class or something, and so we all handed them in. And the day that they had them all laid out, I guess, on a table, and they were writing on them, and they had to call me because two of them got mixed up. And they knew that it was mine and Elizabeth Robleski's. And Judith Regeer called me up and said, we have two Roxus here, and we don't know which is which. And she's describing the stitches to me. And she says, one of them has, you know, pretty even stitches, and then this other one. And she described it, and I could tell her that that one was mine. I wish I still had that Roxu, because I would like to show it to the sewing students sometimes when they're really in despair. But I don't. Huh? We don't talk about what happened to that Roxu. It's in another place now. So.
What I like about them is how unique they do come out looking.
They do.
You know, we try so hard to make an exact replica of the point, you know, and do it all perfect and do it exactly the way it's been done. And then each one comes out being individual and unique.
Mm-hmm. They do.
Challenge that I've been thinking about a lot and different about when I was sewing this, and I hear this word perfect today, is there is no perfection, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just is. I was so judgmental, and this is wrong, this is wrong. And yeah, I guess for me, that's what I struggle with. It's hard to just let that rocket to be until today, what it is, with all the things that I see as imperfection, that are they, you know, is a crooked stitch really a crooked stitch? It isn't, it just, it is, right? And I have a rip in it, in the back of it, and it's a rip. I try to explain it, but it's just a continual practice, just let it be. And not put value for that dualistic thing, good and bad.
To add some storyline to it.
To me.
Yeah, to add some commentary to it. And at the same time, I think that when we see those things coming up, you know, it can be. Some people are real aware. Some people go, yeah, I know, I have these perfectionist tendencies, or I have this tendency to want to get things done and be done with them, and so I rush through things. But other people are really surprised at what they find out about themselves when they do this sewing. Really surprised. If they take the time to stop and look at what's coming up when they're doing it. So there's a really good mirror in that respect. But we can't take that mirror thing too seriously. I like to tease the sewing students about it. It's a mirror of your practice now. But we have to take that lightly too, I think. So I think we need some announcements and then some tea.